We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
And good morning. This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is the producer at the controls this hour. Jason Croft, Kyle Mabry was on hour number one. In this hour of the show, we have a health topic for you, something that we do at least a couple of times throughout the year. We have various physicians on the program who have different specialties, and this time around, our guest is Dr. Lester Farner. He's a dermatologist at Christie Clinic, and his specialty is skin, and that's what we'll be talking about. If you have questions about skin and skin care, he will do his best. I always say when we have doctors here on the program, do keep in mind that because we can't see you, diagnosis over the phone is not something we can do. It's particularly difficult for the dermatologist because they can't say, yeah, hold that rash up to the phone and we'll see what we can do. But we'll do our best. He will do his best to help you out if you have questions. So anything that has to do with skin, you give us a call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And if you'd like to send us an email, you could do that too. It's will-talk@illinois.edu. Thanks very much
for
being here.
Again. Thanks for inviting me.
The thing that I'm sure whenever it's summertime, we always talk about the same thing when we start out, and that is sun exposure and sunscreen. And there's good reason to be talking about sunscreen because there are some new rules on sunscreen that will be going into effect, I think actually, though not officially until next year. Is that right?
Yeah. I didn't see exactly when, but not immediate.
Not immediate. But anyway, the idea is that it's supposed to help people make sure that the sunscreen that they're using actually is effective. And so what now is going to happen here?
Okay. Well, first of all, I'll just say I think they're great because they really are a simplification and pretty helpful. The new stuff is that, well, first of all, let me do a second of science, unfortunately. The ultraviolet spectrum is divided into ultraviolet A and B, and the B is where you get your sunburns, and the SPF number is for the B section. And we've known for a long time that anything under 15 is marginally effective, and everything 15 and over is where you really want to be. So in the last maybe 5 years, we've had screens that also block ultraviolet A. A does more sun damage, drug reactions, wrinkles, freckling, and fewer sunburns, but they both can contribute to skin cancer. So they used to say complete UVA block and the B and the SPF number. Now they call it broad spectrum. And broad spectrum is the name that the FDA lets the manufacturers use, and it means it gets A and B both. So you want to look for something that was labeled broad spectrum. That's number one. Number two, anything 15 and over then will have the right to, which is also broad spectrum, has the right to state that they decrease the risk of sunburn, skin aging from the sun, and skin cancer. Okay, sunburn, aging, and skin cancer. So you're just going to look for something that's broad spectrum and 15, 30, or above. So that makes it very simple. If it's, for example, broad spectrum and only an SPF 8, they won't get to say that claim that they decrease the risk of sunburn. It does marginally, but not enough that the FDA is going to let them say that. So it's nice and easy.
So in the meantime now, before these new things go into effect and we got new packages and so forth, you would still say when you're looking, make sure that you get an SPF that's more than 15.
Yes.
And look, does it say on there that it gives you protection both against UVA and UVB?
Yes.
It'll say that.
It'll be a little more, it'll be the old-fashioned stuff, which says we also block A or, or it'll say 100% UVA block, which, that's clear enough. But it's just easier to pick up. It'll be easier next year when you start picking things off the shelves to get something that you know is in the right power category.
And I think at least in one of the stories that I read about this, there was also some concern about manufacturers putting the word waterproof on the product because the government said, well, nothing is waterproof. And you've made the point that if you're out, you're at the beach and you're swimming,
right,
you will want to think about periodically reapplying.
Right. That's exactly right. So although I still see the claim on there that says waterproof, and I don't know how they get to do that, but it, you know, if you want to be a stickler, and lots of people like this, you'd say highly water resistant. There you go. Okay, yeah. And I'm hoping for sort of a libertarian brand to come up that says idiot proof, and then see if maybe they get a lawsuit about that one. I'm sorry, it didn't work for me.
Mm-hmm. So. Well, then something else that we have talked about, that even sometimes when people do put on sunscreen, they don't put on enough.
Right.
So how do you know how much is enough?
Oh, you know, the dose for arms, legs, trunk, face is supposed to be about a shot glass. So that's 30 milliliters. So there you have it. So if you've got the same bottle in mid or late June that you bought before Memorial Day weekend, you're not using
putting it enough.
Or else you're in the house a lot.
Yeah.
You really do have to put some on.
And in terms of reapplying, even if you haven't been exposed to, you know, even if you haven't been swimming,
right,
how often do you recommend that you reapply?
First thing in the morning before you go out, and then reapply at the middle of the day. So, you know, some people have lunch, so you put it on first thing in the morning, you go ahead and reapply then in the middle of the day. Later in the day, you know, if you go out at 5, I generally don't put on sunscreen at that time of day. It turns out that the B, ultraviolet B, is really the most powerful between, let's say, 10 and 3, 11 and 2. That's when the rays are highest, really when the sun is at the highest peak.
Mm-hmm. I just overheard somebody the other day talking about how they were trying to be really good about putting sunscreen on their children, but then there was one day when it was cloudy and they said, oh, well, we don't have to do it. And I'm thinking, I don't think that's right.
No, the water vapor in clouds doesn't block out the ultraviolet light, so it's actually, you know, it doesn't block it out completely. So no, cloudy days are a good time to get a burn, unfortunately.
And for regular clothing, like a cotton T-shirt, for example,
right,
that does have
an SPF
some,
about
but a
two.
Tiny,
sure,
tiny bit. So
sure,
it does do something, but you shouldn't think that that's really, you're making a big difference having a shirt on. Not having a shirt on probably doesn't make
sense. Unless they're SPF rated. You can buy different brands, you know, outdoor clothing brands will sell clothes with sunscreen ratings. So, you know, those are effective. But a loose cotton weave, particularly when wet, is about useless.
Yeah. Our guest in this hour of Focus is Dr. Lester Farner. He's a dermatologist from Christie Clinic, and we're talking about sun right now and sunscreen. But any other questions you might have that have to do with skin, that's his special area, give us a call, and he'll try to help you out. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. We have a one call and one email, and we'll get them here first with the person on the phone, Gibson City, line number 4. Hello.
Yeah, David, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Just a brief overview, and then I did have a question for the doctor. I went to college some 40 years ago, and when I'm listening now to the doctor and these other articles, and boy, I want to tell you, years ago, the kids literally were putting oil on themselves and basically cooking themselves. I mean, that was kind of the trend. We do the spring break thing with the fraternity brothers the day Daytona Beach, and basically there was no protection. It was basically putting oil on and cooking your skin. I'm very happy that this thing has come full circle and the knowledge level has increased. I was wondering if the doctor could speak. There's been several articles now about these tanning salons. And number one, I don't understand why somebody would want to do that, but that's okay. I mean, I'm in my 50s, so you listen to my kids. I don't know anything anyway. But I just think that it's extremely dangerous. And now these studies are coming out, really adverse effect to the skin and the concentration of tanning the skin and all these kinds of things. And I got to believe it would have a long-term effect also. I was wondering if the doctor could speak on that, and I'll go ahead and listen offline. Thanks.
Okay.
Great. Great question, because there are plenty of tanning beds, and I see plenty of people who are plenty tan. Obviously, I mean, one of the problems is they're year-round available for our Midwesterners here. We've got October through, May even, early May, when people don't get that much sunshine. But you can go into a tanning bed year-round and expose as much of your skin as you wish. And indeed, that does increase your risk of melanoma. It does increase photoaging. It does increase wrinkling and every other bad thing that ultraviolet light does.
Yeah. And there still seems to be good evidence that people are doing tanning beds. In fact, one of the things that I printed up here before we came in was the results of a recent survey that came out in early May from the American Academy of Dermatology. They took a survey of Caucasian girls and women between 14 and 22 and found 32% of the respondents had used a tanning bed in the past year. Of those, a quarter went at least once a week. 81% said they had tan outdoors, either frequently or occasionally. 65% said they think people look more attractive with a tan. And I don't know if men are doing this as much, but clearly they're, in spite of the constant message about this is not a good idea, a lot of people are still doing it.
Right, right. It's one of those frustrating things. People still start smoking cigarettes and do all these things. And I honestly don't know the relative risk of, the tanning as opposed to some of the other awful health risks that people take. So I don't know exactly how I don't have a personal crusade against the tanning beds. I just do know that they're bad, but I don't pound on the table. Obviously, people need to be sensible, not only with the skin cancer, photo damage issues, but also it's hard on the immunologic component of your skin as far as, fighting infections and fighting skin cancers, because the UV light knocks out your antigen-presenting cells. It decreases your T cells that are resident in your skin that are there to fight off infections and other things. So your skin, besides, doing all the other things it does, it's also an immunologic organ of significance.
Well, before there were tanning beds, people went and just lay outside under the sun. Is going to the tanning parlor worse than doing what people used to do and just lying out there under the sun?
Well, it depends on if you had a private backyard and how many of your clothes you took off. It's easy in a tanning bed to take off as many clothes as you like. Mm. So that's a separate issue. At least if you had snoopy neighbors, you might be partly covered up. So. Again, the relative risk is really vanishingly hard to calculate, but there's no question that it's not safe and it's not appropriate. And I get some people who say, "Listen, I'm going to go to the tanning bed 5 times, and then I'm going to go on a cruise, and that way I won't get a sunburn." And I never scold people too long for that. And of course, they still are going to have to wear their sunblock on their trip, so they don't get ruined with a sunburn. But some people just are going to continue to do this in the face of good evidence that they ought not.
I have an email here. This is on a different subject, from someone who writes wanting to know if there have been any breakthroughs recently in the treatment of childhood eczema and prevention of flare-ups. The person here writes, "We alternate Protopic and Desonide to treat our daughter's eczema, but she still has stubborn itchy patches on her hands and arms. How often should we be bathing her? What moisturizer should we use after shower? Have any tips for itching that keeps her awake at night?" The person here says she is 7 and is Asian, and eczema has been a major problem for the past few years.
Sure. Good question as far as breakthroughs. I don't know that there are any specific great breakthroughs. The Protopic is actually an old enough medicine, but it was a nice advance because it is a very effective topical, which does not have any topical steroids in it. So you don't have to worry about skin thinning of the skin, extra blood vessels, pigment alterations that you can see with the steroids. And the desonide that she uses is also is a mild enough to use on a child topical steroid, should be somewhat effective. It's not a high enough category. Sometimes we do have that we worry about it, but sometimes you might need a little boost with something a little more powerful. So alternating between those two medicines sounds like a great regimen. There are two schools of the eczema school. There's the wets and the dries as far as bathing. There are some who say, well, the skin is dried out, so stay out of the bathtub. It will dry it out further. And then, of course, there are wets. And I happen to have been trained a dry and converted to a wet. So soaking in a bathtub for 20 minutes or so and letting your skin get water hydrated, and then you get out and you treat with the topicals and the bad spots, and then you moisturize about everywhere else, and that will then, as we say somewhat theologically, seal in the water, because hydrated skin actually itches less. And moisturizer brands, I don't happen to like Eucerin, which is one of the big brand names that people get started on. I find it a little bit waxy and hard to rub in. So any of the standard brand topical creams, you know. Lotion is a cream with some water frappéed into it. So creams are better than lotions because the water just evaporates out. But my favorite brands, I've got, I like Moisturel. I like what was that? Oh, Cetaphil cream is a very nice cream. I don't have any stock in any of these sorts of things, but just a nice medium weight cream. Anything that doesn't have too many perfumey issues. As far as itching at bedtime, a dose of an oral antihistamine, not one of the non-sedating ones. So Benadryl or hydroxyzine is one of those ones that put some people a little bit to sleep, and that way she'll get a little bit of sleep.
Okay, well, hope that helps. Other questions are welcome for our guest, Dr. Lester Farner. He's a dermatologist, so we're looking for skin care questions. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. And if you'd like to send us an email, you may do that. That's will-talk@illinois.edu. So we talked a little bit about sunscreen. We talked about the new rules. We talked a little bit about what people should, when you're reading labels, what you kind of want to try to be looking for, and maybe also we should review when you're looking at your skin, or you're getting somebody to look at those parts that you can't see. What sort of things are you looking for that you might be concerned about? And then you would say you need to have somebody take a look at this.
Right. That's really tough because people's owner's manual of what skin cancers look like is pretty deficient. You can go on the internet and look at plenty pictures, but it's really hard to leave this to amateurs. You should always show your primary care doctor anything you've got a question about, and of course you can always end up seeing a dermatologist either early or late in that process. Anything that bleeds is a problem. The thought about having a growth on your skin that bleeds it shouldn't do that, quite frankly. So that's one issue. But basal cells and squamous cell carcinomas are really quite common. We see in this country now somewhere around 3 million plus skin cancers a year. So it's not a rare event. And they've got a whole host of different looks. The basal cells were described as having a rolled edge, sort of translucent, a central ulceration, little broken blood vessels called telangiectasias in there. But there are plenty of these things that don't follow the rules. Melanomas are really tough for people to diagnose themselves. Certainly if somebody looks at a growth on you and says, you better go see a doctor, well, then go see them, because I've had a number of people that come in referred in by family members, and they're right about, what happens to be a significant lesion. One of the toughest problems is there are a whole bunch of benign confounding lesions that, do things that satisfy the criteria for skin cancer. So there's a growth called a seborrheic keratosis, which is really incredibly common. and they are kind of a warty, grayish, brownish, elevated, rough, warty thing that's really common on temples, scalps, faces, necks, trunks, and they grow, they get bigger, they get darker, they get traumatized with a towel or a fingernail, and they bleed, and you know, and they can be quite large and quite dark, and lots of people come in and they've got a bunch of these and nothing else. So it's really hard for lay population to see it, but medical professionals generally have to have developed a pretty good eye for this.
All right. We have someone here who is calling on a cell phone, so we'll get right there, and this is line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have dark circles under my eyes. Is there anything that can be done to change the color of that skin?
Well, believe it or not, that's a more complicated answer than you'd expect. There are a couple reasons to have dark circles under your eyes, and how you would have that fixed depends on the cause of it. Some people have chronic eye area rashes if they've got mild allergies, they have got eczema, they are allergic to some eye area cosmetics, and then they end up with chronic pigmentation there just from the chronic low-grade rash. That can be treated with topical steroids, avoidance of the allergens, and so on. Some people have dark circles just underneath the lowermost part of their actual eyelid in what's called the tear trough. So were you to cry, that's where the tears would hit first and then move laterally on your cheek. And there are two reasons for that. One is some people have got a pretty big collection of blood vessels there. So what you're seeing is sort of the bluish aspect of the blood vessels underneath there. And that's hard to do. There's some people who inject those or laser off the blood vessels. I'm a little bit dicey about that myself. So I would think, you know, I know some, you know, there are people in the plastic surgery world that would approach that. The other reason is that as you get a little older, the fat pad that is just underneath your eyelid migrates a little bit downward. And as it goes down, it leaves that tear trough area. And the dusky color you're seeing is actually the color of the muscles that squint your eyes and close your lower eyelid. So that you fix by putting a filler on top of the muscle to give a little bit of space between the periocular muscles and the surface of the skin. So you'd put a filler in there. There are also a bunch of creams that you can buy in doctor's offices and buy at department stores that they've got, you know, the eye area creams and gels to lighten the color. And those make claims, and I don't know that there's any great science for whether or not those work. But that's where I always have people start, is with one of the creams that with the eye. Because the other ways of approaching this, unless it's just a rash that's giving you some pigment, those get fairly expensive fairly fast.
Could you talk a little bit about mycosis fungoides, what it is and how it's treated? And I'm going to listen offline then.
All right. Yeah, thanks.
Great.
For the question.
Okay. Yeah. Mycosis fungoides is an interesting condition, and you'd like to hope it was rare, but it's not quite. In fact, I saw a lady in my office with it yesterday. She's a follow-up patient, but it's the Greek word for fungus and the Latin word for fungus put together. So Greek word first, mycosis, fungoides, the Latin word for fungus. So it's called fungus in the old dermatology jargon, but I don't use the term. It actually is in the lymphoma category. So it's called really correctly cutaneous T-cell lymphoma, so CTCL. It's malignant T cells which migrate out to the epidermis instead of wanting to live in your bone marrow, your lymph nodes, your circulation. They're what we call epidermotrophic. So as they circulate, they hit the vessels of the skin and then they migrate out to the skin. Diagnosis is sometimes a little tough because it looks like all sorts of other rashes initially. but it's got enough of a distinctive look that a dermatologist will make the diagnosis pretty promptly usually. It's a biopsy diagnosis, and it tends to be quite indolent and with a nice long course. So the old textbooks that were out there when I started training 30 years ago said, well, don't worry. It takes 10 years to diagnose. And then once you've made the diagnosis, these people have been carried as having a rash or psoriasis or eczema. And then 10 years in, they get diagnosed as actually having cutaneous T-cell lymphoma. We do have a variety of treatments, and then 20 years later is when you have to worry about them dying. Frankly, the prognosis is actually much better than that. So it's an interesting condition.
All right. We have another caller here. Let us talk with them. And someone in Champaign on our line number one. Hello.
Yes, hello. Mm-hmm. I was wondering have you talked about rosacea yet?
No.
I have had it for some time. It was originally treated with Accutane for a while. I think that's a no-no these days. I'm currently using Metrocream occasionally, but I do flush quite a bit. I was wondering if there's another product that would be do a little better for control.
Sure.
It's just on the face. Just on my face.
Right.
Cheeks, nose, cheeks primarily.
Right. Well, that's the classic location for that. Rosacea is basically a central facial form of acne that we see in adults. And I don't know where adult stops and starts. And in fact, we actually see some children with rosacea, but it's predominantly nose and central cheek, lower forehead centered. It can actually be much more widespread than that. And it's got three components. It's got dilated broken blood vessels or telangiectasias that you see as one of the findings for chronic patients. It's got little papules, pimples, pustules, and then the third one is the flushing.
Yeah, fortunately, it's not progressed beyond just the flushing.
Great.
And, it's probably had it for, 10, 12 years.
Okay.
I didn't use Metrocream for quite a while, and recently I'm starting to flush. Occasionally, sometimes even when I'm not outside, get sun,
Right. It's stimulated by alcohol, spicy foods, anything that you can?
I don't really drink much alcohol. I just some spicy food. I don't really have a correlation. Sometimes it just happens, I can't seem to track what's causing it.
But right.
It's not all the time, but it's just occasionally.
And it's really troublesome because it's really the flushing is the hardest to control, quite frankly. The papules, pustules, bumps, things like that. The Metro Gel, Metro Cream, the topical antibiotics are actually pretty effective at that. The other thing we treat with sometimes is oral antibiotics, and I don't know that I've got any proof that helps with the flushing all that much. There's a very low dose doxycycline pill that I like because it doesn't induce any. Have you been on one of those?
Excuse me, I'm sorry. My wife was talking to me. What?
Oh, there's a very low dose doxycycline pill that actually doesn't induce any bacterial resistance, and it's got a very nice side effect profile that I use in patients with chronic rosacea.
Okay.
The other thing, there's another cream or gel called Finacea Gel. That's a brand name, and it has
spelled with an F.
Yes, F as in Finacea.
Okay.
And it's another nice medication because it works with the redness. Again, the flushing's tough, but if you keep the redness down as a baseline, I think you probably have a little bit less flushing.
Yeah, fortunately, it's not real bad, but it just comes up, so I think I'm pretty lucky that way.
Good.
The other part's with doxycycline, is that correct?
Yes, doxycycline.
Cycline. Yeah. Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
All right, thank you. We are looking for your questions this morning about skin and skincare. Our guest is Dr. Lester Farner from Christie Clinic, and we'll talk some more and take some more calls after a short break. This is Focus.
On the next Fresh Air, why fatty foods, orgasm, exercise, marijuana, generosity, vodka, learning, and gambling feel so good. We'll talk to neuroscientist David Linden about the pleasure circuitry of the brain, how it's activated, and how that can sometimes turn into addiction. His new book is called The Compass of Pleasure. Join us.
this afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. We have 10 different topics for you each week. Tomorrow, in the 10 o'clock hour, our guest will be Mara Vistendahl. She's a Beijing-based correspondent for science, and we will talk about a new book that she's authored. The title is Unnatural Selection, Choosing Boys Over Girls and the Consequences of a World Full of Men, which takes a look at a phenomenon that we're starting to see more and more in particular places around the world, where couples are having babies and they are very aggressively selecting for sex. That is because they want sons and not daughters, and we're starting to see problems related to this mismatch of males and females. So we'll talk about that with her tomorrow. And then in the second hour, some more programs from what we're calling the Deep Archives. This year, our program focus turned 30, and we thought it'd be interesting to go back and repeat some interviews from past years that hadn't been heard in a long time and aren't part of our web archive. And tomorrow you can hear edited portions of two conversations with two writers well known for writing about religion, Houston Smith and Rabbi Harold Kushner. Those are interviews from the mid-90s. We'll have those tomorrow. We're here weekday mornings 10 to noon. You can check up on the schedule by going to our website. You can also listen to past programs that way. It's will.illinois.edu. And in this hour, our guest is Dr. Lester Farner. He's a dermatologist from Christie Clinic. We're talking about skin and skin care. And if you have questions, give us a call, 333-9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. And we got some more folks here to talk with, starting with someone in Indiana on our line 4, the toll-free line. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I recently just simply got back from my dermatologist a short time ago, and the first time I saw her, she talked about some basal carcinoma. And she found a number of things on my forehead and used nitrogen gas to remove it. And when I went back, everything turned out okay. Then I'm scheduled for a full-body screening. One thing she said on my foot, I had a callus, and that was she more or less passed over that very quickly. The one thing that does concern me about the callus, sometimes when you're looking at it, it looks like skin has, I'll say broken, but I don't mean that in any detrimental sense, in a circular path around something that's in the center. And eventually that center thing erupts into a very small yellowish ellipsoidal thing. My mother would call it probably the head of something. And I was wondering what that is.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. I've got four of them. I've collected them because I'm sure she's going to go same thing.
You've got four on one foot or two on each?
No, just one, but the tops of them that you can pick out with your fingernail, I've got four of them.
Okay.
And it's sort of cyclical sort of thing, and it doesn't hurt or anything. Sometimes I put a lot of pressure in that area, the callus just reacts, by, you've got to stop this, and I take it off. But this thing that's in the center, I was just wondering what that might be.
Okay. Is this over a pressure point, like it would be over the head of one of the balls of your feet?
Yeah, it's on the ball of my feet, my left foot and thigh.
Right. So up on the front, not on the heel then?
No, it's up on the front, what they call the ball of the foot, before the toes.
Right. So, first of all, it really could be that she's right, that it's a callus. Sometimes we've got a even fancier word that we call it a clavus. But if you think about, a callus, if you're repetitively using a tool or lifting weights, you get that thickening of the outer layer of skin from the external pressure. On the sole of your foot, what happens is the bone pounds on the skin from the inside, and then it exerts pressure on the outside of your foot, and then it thickens up and it makes this really firm callus, which actually is firm, dead, adherent, dry skin, which sometimes will indeed separate from the normal thickness of the surrounding skin. And it actually is the same functional equivalent as a corn that's between your toes. So when you're removing this ellipsoidal thing, you're actually, in essence, taking away enough of the callus that it's going to be a little bit more comfortable. So I think that her diagnosis might be right, but when you go back for your full body exam, just leave it undisturbed. And if I see people with this, I'll just take a scalpel and trim it out, and you can tell then the difference between this and a wart, because warts have got a different wartier surface. And of course, there I got to throw in the caveat that there's the rare instance of people having a non-pigmented melanoma of their foot. And so I want you to leave it truly undisturbed so she gets a good chance of seeing it intact and make sure she spends enough time looking at it. And she'll as a dermatologist, she'll, I have to guess, will be make the right decision here.
Okay, well, thanks a lot.
All right, thanks. Well, I'm sure I'm thinking now the fact we spend so much time talking about sun and sun exposure that some people might say, what you mean I could get a skin cancer on my foot?
Right, right. The distribution of basal and squamous cell carcinomas, which we've known forever, have been, you know, they were seen in farmers and fishermen and people outdoors all the time, mm-hmm. and on the backs of your hands, your nose, your tops of your ears, all the sun-exposed skin places predominant. Melanomas have a much more uniform distribution across the skin surface, and in fact, in places that truly are not particularly sun exposed. So you can get them on your toenail bed. You can get them on the soles of your feet. You can get them in the folds of your hiney crack. I mean, they just can be about everywhere they want. Mm. And our association with them, with sun exposure, turns out that that's both a genetic issue on some level. More pale people, redheads, blondes, and so on, as well as an early childhood sunburn, which actually increase your risks. So, and as well as chronic ongoing sun exposure, but it's not really a sun exposure distribution where melanomas will predominate.
Okay,
it's a surprise, but that's what it is.
Mm-hmm. Other callers. Next is Urbana, line one. Hello.
Yes, I wanted to know what you can use for worsening acne in pregnancy or if you're breastfeeding?
That's a tough one, isn't it? Because there's, you know, we're of course reticent to use anything that's going to hurt a fetus or a baby when you're in gestation or being nursed. So, and it's interesting, some women will get better with their acne when they're pregnant, and some indeed will worsen, and it can be relatively severe. The old standbys of benzoyl peroxide, and we don't like using quite so much anymore as we used to. So typically, my standby right now is the medication I mentioned before, Finacea. I mentioned it in the context of rosacea because it's a wheat extract. It's a, you know, it's a natural product which is extracted out of wheat, and it's perfectly safe to use, and it opens up little plugged up oil glands, and it decreases the redness and irritation. I also will use topical antibiotics like clindamycin during pregnancy, which have to be considered pretty safe as long as you're just using it on faces. You don't want to be using it all across a back or covered skin where you would absorb more. We can have people, some women who are pregnant or nursing, we let them use some oral antibiotics, but you have to be really selective in that.
Mm-hmm.
You're,
okay.
Yeah, you're kind of in a tough spot to get treated.
Finacea is by prescription?
Yes, it's a prescription item, although, you know, it's wonderfully safe.
Okay. Thanks so much.
All right, thank you. Other questions again? Welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And the email is will-talk at illinois.edu. I'm thinking about the when I make my annual visit to my physician just to get a checkup. He doesn't seem to be making a particular point of looking at my skin, although, you know, I'm there and it's there right in front of him. So I guess I'm thinking if there's something really obvious, he's going to see it. But I'm wondering how many doctors, say family doctors, or if you're just getting a routine physical, actually spend much time looking at your skin and looking for possible problems.
It's a great question, and one that I can't answer because I'm on the receiving a referral end. So I get referrals from family physicians and, you know, internists, pediatricians who are really good at this, and I can tell who's good and who's not. But I can tell who's good, but I really can't know who's not. because, you know, I say, oh, well, this person's got a good eye, and they send me appropriate referrals, and other people send me about everybody, and that's, you know, that's okay for me. It does increase, you know, how much work one has to do and how many copays the patient has to pay. But they're, you know, if I think this is one where it would behoove you to do a self-exam ahead of time and, you know, look in the mirror and do all that stuff. And then if you have anything that's the least bit interesting, bring it to that physician's attention and, you know, ask them to focus on it for a while. And generally, they can make pretty good decisions.
Well, say, so say you have something that you're concerned about and that you would like to have your doctor look at, and you're scheduled to have a physical in 6-8 months.
Right.
Is it okay to wait, or do you want to go, say, right now?
Again, a tough thing, because you're going to get in right now, and they're going to say, well, that's nothing. And then you feel a little foolish, but then, you know, but then again, depends on what you have. Mm-hmm. You have to know what you have. And how can you know what you have? Because you don't know. Yeah. Yeah, it's an epistemologic question, unfortunately. How are you going to know how important it is to go see somebody?
Okay. Well, I suppose that, you know, the safe advice is to say, well, to be on the safe side, and you want to sleep at night, if something's really,
right,
if you're worried, go and have a look at it.
And then the other thing is, have a good baseline. Okay, I have people come to me, they say, well, I'm 42 or I'm 51 and I've got a family history of whatever, and I wanted my good baseline exam and to get started from there. And then they ask me how often they maybe need to come see me. And if they've got a negative family history of melanoma and they don't do excessive sun exposure, then I say, maybe every year, maybe every other year. Some people who are loaded with unusual moles and have a positive family history, we put them on a more frequent schedule.
Okay. Urbana, another caller, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah.
Both my parents got shingles in their later years,
mm-hmm,
and I'm 53, and I'm wondering if it would make any sense or if it's even possible to get that shingles vaccine prior to age 60.
Great question. It was tested, as you know, in two age cohorts, 60 to 70, 70 to 80, it's a good vaccination. It doesn't protect everybody from getting shingles, and in fact, it's more successful in the younger age cohort, which just reflects a more intact immune system, which is able to respond appropriately with an antibody response to make it more effective. But it still is a very good vaccine. And here's where the issue is. It would be perfectly safe to give to you. I think, did you say you were 53?
Yes.
Be perfectly safe to give to you at this point. It would be perfectly appropriate to give it to you at this point. And the issue is going to be, can you find a way to get your insurance company to pay for it? It's a fairly expensive vaccination. So,
okay, but I won't get shingles from it. But
no.
There's no chance of that.
No, there's no chance of getting that from the vaccine.
Okay,
and it is more effective if you get it. You know, if you're not too worried, I'd just make sure you were 60 years plus one day old, and then make sure you get the vaccine, because shingles can be quite debilitating.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah. So, and the other thing is, the people who get shingles when they're younger actually have a lot less risk of postherpetic pain, neuralgia, prolonged healing, and all those other issues. So you might be able to go bare for the next 7 years. But if you do get shingles, if people who get shingles, if they get in and are diagnosed and treated promptly, actually also have a much better course than if the diagnosis still is delayed.
Okay, I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Shingles can be a really painful and unpleasant experience. I'm sure one of the things that for doctors and it's a big puzzle is that shingles is caused by the virus that causes chickenpox.
Correct.
And at least if you look back to the point where before we had the chickenpox vaccine, everybody got chickenpox, but everybody doesn't get
chickenpox.
Shingles.
No, right,
it goes. Right, chickenpox. Right. It goes and hides in your body, and then some people it comes back later as the shingles. But not everybody ends up with shingles. And do they really know why is that some people later end up with shingles, but probably most people don't.
Most people don't, but it's sort of a function of it comes up generally when you are immunologically debilitated. So it shows up in people who've just had surgery, or they've just had chemotherapy, or they're just older and their immune system stops suppressing the growth of the chickenpox virus as it marches down your sensory nerve and reinfects your skin, and it tears the nerve up and makes it hurt like the dickens, sometimes for months and months and months. So you know, I mean, you could be glib, and some people just die of a heart attack at 42, and then they don't end up having to go through the shingles. You know, and I don't know that anybody is fated to, no matter what, have shingles.
And now that we are starting to vaccinate people against chickenpox, is the thinking there that, you know, not only will they not get chickenpox, but then later in life they won't get shingles either?
That's the thinking. The problem is, some of these people, you know, the vaccine isn't as protective against getting the chickenpox as native chickenpox. Oh. So they've actually had to add a chickenpox booster shot in the original series of vaccinations.
Okay. We have, maybe about 5-6 minutes here. Someone wants to call very quickly. They can get in a question for the doctor. Skin care, that's the topic, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Here's something I thought I just might ask you quickly about, that's a particularly seasonal thing. Some people, when they get bitten by an insect, you know, a mosquito or whatever, have that, they just, and I'm one of those people, I get these huge welts. They just swell up. Fortunately, they go away fairly quickly, but you know, some folks have this really strong reaction. What do you recommend for doing a little first aid if you have that kind of reaction to a bite?
I'm one of those people too, so I hate insect bites, and I do spend some time outdoors, but I'll get a mosquito bite, and it's the silver dollar size kind of response, and three of those on your face, and you just don't want to be anywhere. Some topical steroids, gels, actually work fast enough. If you are having lots of responses, you actually could go on one of the non-sedating antihistamines, because this one is a histamine-mediated reaction. Mm-hmm. So you could use topical Benadryl has some utility, but you could stay on Zyrtec and Allegra and Claritin, are all three of them non-sedating and available over the counter. So you could just, during the bad insect period, you could just take one of those a day for a while and see how that does, and have some topical Benadryl on hand. And maybe if you have a physician who'd write you a prescription for one of the topical gels that gets absorbed quickly for the steroids. Yeah.
Do the over-the-counter things you're talking about, these non-sedating antihistamines that drugstore and buy them, do they work fast enough so that, okay, you get the bite, you get the reaction, right away, and if you pop one, can it actually do anything?
No, that's why you want them on board.
Ah, okay.
See, you want to block the histamine sites, otherwise you're playing catch-up. Okay. That's the same thing that happens with people with hives. I say, stay ahead of the game, because otherwise you got to wait for the histamine to come off the receptor and then get replaced with the antihistamine. So
after the fact, it's not going to help.
Not as much.
All right. A couple callers here. Dewey, line one. Hello.
Hi. I just wanted to ask if you already have shingles that's mild but recurrent. Does the vaccine help in that regard?
If when you say recurrent shingles, if this is a second episode, that's one thing. Some people have the diagnosis of shingles because it comes back every year or so on their arm, their thumb, the lower back, something like that. And that really, frankly, isn't shingles. That's the herpes simplex virus that comes back.
This is in my scalp, and it forms a little blister-like things that are painful, and if you rupture them, then they'll heal and this pain will stop. I assumed it's shingles, but I'm not absolutely certain about that. But I definitely had shingles diagnosed when it first happened. It came out after a period of stress, and it was affecting my ear and skin around the side of my face a little bit, all up in my scalp, but basically in the same place, except the ear now has never been involved again.
Yeah. Well, I think that when this is coming out, you should see a physician, and then they can do either a viral culture or something to make a firmer diagnosis. Because if this is indeed coming back and it's in the shingles category, you would want to have the vaccine. But I think you need a certain diagnosis first, because you could be getting recurrent folliculitis. You could get some staph bacteria, strep, something like that. That it'd all be worth getting sorted out when you've got the actual intact erosions, blisters, pustules, then see a physician.
But the vaccine is viable for people that have had it to prevent it from coming back?
Sure, yes.
Thank you.
All right, one more we'll try here on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Hey, my name is Bob, and I just wanted to ask, I've had multiple basals removed off my back.
Yes.
And they all healed kind of flat. And red,
yes.
Except one on my shoulder has a pretty big knot, and it itches bad.
Right.
Is there anything we can do for that?
Right. Yeah, that's not a surprise. On the wherever there's tight biological tension, like over prominences on shoulders, across bony prominences like jawlines, you can get what we call a hypertrophic scar. So instead of being flat, reddish, or white, they get elevated. Indeed, they are firm. Sometimes they're tender and they itch. It's sort of halfway to being a keloid. And they can just be injected with a dilute steroid, or dilute or high potency, depending on the thickness. And an injection or two will flatten down the excessive collagen that you've laid down.
They stick a needle right in there and inject it.
Yes, that's exactly it.
Okay, I just wondered what we could do. Thank you.
Yeah, that'll help.
Thank you. Well, we're just about done. Just one real quick. We tell people, watch out for the sun. We tell them to wear sunscreen. At the same time, we hear from time to time about vitamin D deficiency.
Sure.
So I guess the question is, well, to have this thing that happens in your skin to get your vitamin D,
right?
How much sun do you actually have to be exposed to?
10 minutes.
Okay, so just a tiny bit.
Yeah, you don't have to go out. Yeah, so your excuse of why you look like a Coach handbag is not vitamin D.
Vitamin D.
No.
Okay. Well, I thank you very much for being here. We appreciate it. Our guest this morning, Dr. Lester Farner. He is a dermatologist at Christie Clinic in Champaign.